And using oral history is very intentional because we know that oftentimes our communities are left out of the historical record. And even within that, women are often left out, right? Queer folks are often left out. So oral history provides a way for us to center specific voices that are left out. And I think public history has the same sort of intention, is to make sure that we're learning about history through the people that experience them.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to Meet. In today's episode, I sat down with some of the members from the West Side Sound Oral History Project, made up of a team that includes academics, historians, and multiple community perspectives. The project aims to archive a genre of music synonymous with San Antonio. Dr. Sylvia Mendoza is an assistant professor of Mexican American Studies at UTSA. Dr. Gloria Vasquez Gonzalez is a lecturer in the Mexican American Studies program at UTSA. Jeremy Landin is a graduate student in the School of Public History at St. Mary's University. Rooted in the cultural pride of the West Side, but inspired by many genres of music, the project aims to foster a space in which underrepresented voices are heard, documented, and captured for the future generation.
If everybody could start by introducing yourselves and your positions at UTSA.
My name is Gloria Vasquez Gonzalez, and I'm a lecturer in the Mexican American Studies program. And I'm also the co-director of the Teachers Mass Academy that we have every year.
My name is Sylvia Mendoza, and I'm an assistant professor of Mexican American Studies at UTSA.
I'm Jeremy Landin. I'm actually not at UTSA. I'm a student at St. Mary's University in the Graduate School of Public History, but I'm also a library board trustee for District 5, and I work for Bexar County Commissioner Rebecca Clay Flores.
How did each of you kind of get involved with the Oral History Project? What did those early kind of process, those early steps look like?
I have known Gloria for through Mexican American Studies and through her research on women in the Tejano music industry. And we both teach courses in Mexican American Studies. And I know Jeremy from living down the street from me, also while he was campaigning in District 5 here on the West Side.
And of course, I know Sylvia through the our common work that we do in the Mexican American department. So Mexican American Studies, part of the REGS, which is the Race, Ethnicity, Gender, and Sexuality Studies.
Yeah, and I was invited by Dr. Mendoza. So I feel like she kind of gave the end to how we all ended up on here though.
Also part of our team is Jaime Macias. He's listed in the grant and he's part of our team. And I met Jaime through Jeremy, and Jaime is the owner of Jaime's Place, a music venue and a bar here on the West Side. So he's also a part of our team as well.
The Mexican American Studies, is that a specific like degree track that people can follow, or is it more so like classes specifically that kind of cater towards a broader degree?
I think it's actually both. We do have a master's degree but it's also something that people can just, we call it an alternative where they can get a double, what we call a double dip major, where they would replace electives and come up with another degree in Mexican American Studies in addition to what their major field of study that they want to pursue.
Found the West Side Community Partnerships Initiative, part of this like strategic plan within UTSA. Can you speak about the kind of the broader presence of that initiative and kind of what it entails and how it even relates to, you know, to this current project?
Yeah, so the West Side Community Partnerships out of UTSA, and that is currently directed by Dr. Roger Enriquez. So they are the ones that are offering up a couple of faculty seed grants. There's about 5 or 6 faculty seed grants, and we're one of them. And then there's also a fellowship offered to a scholar to do work focusing on specifically the West Side. And so the objectives of this specific grant through the West Side Community Partnerships Initiative is to make sure that we are fostering preliminary work that leads to larger research projects that prove the West Side's buenestar, which means the community well-being. So we thought this was a perfect way for us to connect the university to the community and to really focus on a genre of music that is a source of cultural pride for specifically the West Side, but definitely for all of San Antonio. And we were really excited that we were selected as one of the five grants that's being offered through the initiative, because we are focused on music, right, and in the humanities. So it is nice for that to be included in the research.
What does the team for this project look like? Is it kind of a small thing, or is it, you know, kind of a broad scale? Obviously, we've got, you know, Jeremy's at St. Mary's, and you've got people here from UTSA. Does it kind of cross disciplines? Does it obviously cross universities? Are there like your city officials or people, activists in the community that are part of this? Like, what does that look like exactly?
I'll say just from what I think about the group, we really do come from such varying backgrounds. You know, we've got, you know, I work in a public office. I work for a county commissioner. You know, you've got two professors from UTSA who are not just professors, but also community leaders and advocates in their own right. And then you've got Jaime, who on his own is someone who really pushes towards, you know, greater equity in the community, but while also supporting small business. So that's a, you know, sometimes something that people think there's no way you can have both, right? But it's like, no, you can do both. And so we have a wide range of experiences and a wide range of knowledge. You know, one of the things I appreciate about historians, and I was just talking to Dr. Mendoza about this yesterday, is like, now it's getting to a point where, you know, you don't have to, there's academics and people who have like are trained in history. And then there's community historians who are not necessarily trained in history, but they understand the history of their culture and their community. And I think that's what we have a mix of, is academics who also represent that. And then also, you know, people like me and Jaime who are not necessarily in that field per se.
And as far as sort of my academic and research training, I do draw from ethnic studies pedagogies and methodologies, as well as feminist pedagogies and methodologies. And that's why the oral history part of this is so important. Jeremy also has expertise in public history. And using oral history is very intentional, because we know that oftentimes our communities are left out of the historical record. And even within that, women are often left out, right? Queer folks are often left out. So oral history provides a way for us to center specific voices that are left out. And I think public history has the same sort of intention, is to make sure that we're learning about history through the people that experience them. And I think that's one of our goals with this project, is to definitely talk to musicians and folks who have a technical and like traditional historical understanding of the genre, but to also talk to folks in the community who listened into and enjoyed the music, right? And so I think that goes back to your question of including, your question also applies to the participants, right? We are thinking about who are some of the folks that we should see included, right? Like Henry Pepsi Pena, who Dr. Gonzalez interviewed, but also doing interviews, like in my case with my own mother, who I learned about West Side Sound music from, and in Jeremy's case from his grandmother as well too. So making sure we have different forms of expertise included in the folks who we are interviewing.
I think that oral history is the best way to capture this, right? I mean, to do it, to write it, you know, it would just be so different. This is the best way, because you hear the passion that some of these people have for this. It for me, it's the only way to capture this type of history.
This is kind of a little bit off of that. What does the process look like for kind of gathering and assembling, you know, this pool of people to interview? Are you kind of going into the community or reaching out to these kind of, you know, you use the term, these community historians, you know, people like Jaime? Are you kind of using the community kind of to help pull people together to pull interviews from? Like, you know, what does that process look like?
I think initially we came up with, we started making a list, you know, just to have some idea of maybe who some of the prospective interviewees should be. And then from there, we more or less went our individual, you know, from there, we heard people, like in my case, some names keep coming up. So those are the ones that I want to go after.
We're relying on Gloria's expertise, having been in the Tejano music industry for 17 years. We're also drawing from Jaime's current relationships with folks that he does bring in and hire at Jaime's place, as well as Jeremy's experience too. Jeremy has a lot of connections, not just from having run for city council, but from the current work and activism that he does. And from that list of pool that Dr. Gonzalez mentioned, folks have, I guess the technical term in research is like snowball sampling. Folks have been saying like who you should really talk to get this perspective though is so-and-so. So Henry Pepsi Pena has done that. Almost all of the folks that we've interviewed have said like you should really talk to so-and-so if you want to learn about X, Y, and Z. And that's been really exciting in the projects.
Yeah, what I'll tell you is interesting is that originally, and it's part of the grant application that shows that, you know, that people would receive a gift card, right, or some sort of reimbursement for their time. But what I found interesting was there were some people that I was like, well, you know, I just did one or two, and like, I don't want to overpass the amount that we have for gift cards. And they're like, we don't care about gift cards. We just want to share what's, you know, what's coming. We just want to share so that this doesn't get lost, so that it's not forgotten, right? They could care less about gift cards, you know, so they're more like, hey, we just want to share with the community the knowledge we have, especially the older folks that we've interviewed, or that I have, at least, you know, from my grandma, it felt like so much more of a personal interview, because here's these pictures of my grandpa and my grandma, like she could care less about stuff like that. She's like, hey, I just want to show somebody what we, she said, We were good looking kids back then. So, you know, then you've got, you know, people like Rich, who I interviewed, who is a DJ currently and who was a DJ then, who's like, I just want to make sure somebody hears this story, right? I just want to make sure someone knows what's going on. So it's also been a want of theirs, you know, it started with a want and need of ours and it turned into a want of theirs. And I think that's what's been really, really powerful.
And UTSA Special Collections has offered to house the interviews. So we're really excited and grateful about that. But we do hope, I think, to open it up more to the community for folks to submit any pictures or artifacts. But I think before really doing that, we'll have to sort of figure out like where we would house those things or how we would go about appropriately housing folks. Yeah, personal information, their pictures from the past. Because the special collections will do the interviews, but some of the other stuff we would have to figure out. And Jaime is also key in terms of making sure that what we do collect is accessible in a small exhibit. And we're shooting for the beginning of May to sort of have a community exhibit that's not on campus, right? It's at Jaime's place. You don't have to buy a parking pass or you don't have to navigate a huge university campus. You literally can just roll through into the barrio and park. And we hope to show snippets of the interviews there. And again, that's really intentional to make sure that folks have access to this.
You mentioned UTSA Special Collections. I was curious, you know, if there's been any kind of like working relationship already as far as like, you know, kind of combing through archives. And I know I had a digital humanities project last semester that I spent a considerable amount of time, you know, in their archives and specifically kind of in their, you know, newspaper collections and stuff. And have you guys kind of been working alongside of them? You know, what does that look like?
We met with them recently with Amy Rushing and Julian or Jillian, I'm getting the name wrong right now. But we met with them recently to go over the guidelines for the oral history interviews. And it's pretty much understood that they will be housing them, that the Oral History Project for the West Side Sound has a home there. And I know that that's part of their very intentional work towards making sure there is more community representation and diverse representation in the archives, which archiving has a history of privileging, right, folks who are considered worthy of being included in the historical record. So it was really great to have that meeting with them and to discuss having community voices in there.
What's kind of some of the cultural and historical roots of this West Side Sound look like? What is, obviously it's this UTSA article alludes to this kind of fusion of certain musical genres, but was there also this kind of, you know, central genre that kind of helped inspire the ones around that? Like what did those early days kind of look like as far as, you know, cultural perspectives or kind of the historical roots that are kind of imbued in the music?
Gloria, I think
I keep muting myself because of my dog. They're like, oh my gosh.
No worries.
But anyway, yes, this is it is a particular sound that was it is uniquely San Antonio, but it is influenced by all these other genres. You know, it is rock and roll, it is doo-wop, it is swamp pop, it is, you know, Motown. But it's our interpretation. It was done by these teenagers. It was really teenagers that, Yeah. These influences were here. And I think that because of the military, we are a military town. So we have so much more diversity, not only, you know, also musically, you know, musically, food wise and all these, not just people wise. And I think that it was these teenagers that went to these places where they were not supposed to be in the first place, but they went anyway. And they liked this sound, you know, what they heard, the different sounds that they heard. And then they came back and tried to reproduce it. But of course, it's the way that we reproduced it, right? It was, and they were not professional musicians. You know, these were teenagers putting together garage bands. That's really what they started out. Even though some went on to fame, like Sonny and the Sunliners, you know, the Sunglows, the Royal Jesters, all these groups, but they went on to fame. And they started out as garage bands that did school dances. That was, you know, their claim to fame, you know, was that they got to do the school dances. And they became famous within the community, the West Side. You know, everybody knew who they were. Maybe I'm not from San Antonio. I'm from Temple, but I had never heard of them. You know, some of them, you know, I knew of Sonny and the Sunliners after they went from garage band to, you know, a full-time touring band. Okay. The Royal Jesters were also another group that crossed and went outside of San Antonio that gained fame. Okay. So it's this like a fusion of all these sounds, but it's done our way, you know, the West Side way. It's whatever we do, we can't get away from our identity. So it's in there. So it's that's basically what it started out, what it is, how a lot of people, of course, I think Jeremy has said it's different things to different people because there is not one standard definition. You know, that's just like an overall. But if you ask somebody, I did Mike Torres III from La 45, one of the up and coming groups that is influenced by the sound. And he's like, well, it's that beat, bah, 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 you know, and I'm like, OK, I'm not a musician, but I know because I've heard it before. But that's what it means to him. You know, two saxophones, too, you know, and I'm like, oh, OK, you know, but everybody has a different. He's doing it musically, you know, to him because he's a musician. But ask maybe Jeremy's grandmother or Sylvia's mother. That's not their definition. So it's I think a lot of it, it's emotional. Now, when you ask people, it's an emotional connection and an emotional, how they would define it is more emotional than technically.
I think back to like, a lot of this, the kind of, you mentioned like doo-wop and like early rock and roll. This is, I'm thinking back to like the music that my grandfather, both of my grandfathers probably would have listened to as well. Both of them kind of come from, you know, military backgrounds as well, both being in San Antonio, as you've mentioned. So, you know, sometimes songs are put, you know, cast onto, you know, political movements or civil rights movements. Were there songs or you know, bands like that at the time that were, you know, on the West Side that kind of had certain political or certain kind of you know, social undertones to some of this music?
I think that's a great question. I know Dr. Gonzalez has talked about West Side Sound really influencing. So West Side Sound drawing from Swamp Pop, right? And also Conjunto Norteño, and then eventually developing into West Side Sound, but then also developing into Tejano. And within Tejano music, we have Little Joe, who was and still is very much affiliated with the Chicano civil rights movement. And this was the decade or the period after sort of like the golden years of West Side Sound. And so that's the first thing that comes to my mind. And Little Joe will actually be performing at the Cesar Chavez March on Saturday. So still very much has political ties to through his music and through his one song, Las Nubes, which was associated with the United Farm Workers Movement. I like your question because I think that's something that's coming up in the interviews. So in the interview with my mom, she talked a bit about how some of the musicians were pushouts. They didn't finish high school. They were pushed out of high school for different reasons. And a lot of them did end up joining the military. And so while I can't think right now specifically if any of the bands were like associated with particular like social movements, I do think that what was happening socially around the time of the West Side Sound is very telling. The fact that you do have mostly Chicanos, Latinos exiting school for whatever reason. At the time, there was also sort of walkouts happening in Texas and San Antonio as well. And so I'm hoping that what will emerge in interviews is that we'll be able to access. And I think this is the thing about oral histories and doing research in historically underserved communities is finding those stories and then finding the artifacts, right? So what I do have hope for is that we are going to be able to find newspaper clippings or archival information that is going to help us fill in some of the gaps of like, well, what was happening around these musicians, right? My mom in her interview mentioned that right now the West Side is largely associated with like cultural pride and tradition and musicians and art and youth activism. But she said growing up being from the West Side that it didn't have those connotations, right? And oftentimes if you were from the West Side and you told other folks, there was lots of stereotypes associated with it. There was the existence of gangs, right? And for me, that tells me that young people were responding to oppression. They were responding to things that were happening. There was the existence of gangs. If you had people dropping out of school, if you had teenagers creating these garage bands, then there had to be something going on. So hopefully, as we collect these interviews and as we hear more stories from people who were students at the time, people who were activists at the time, then maybe we can piece together and have sort of like the historical documentation that tells us like, here's the soundtrack for these things that were occurring in this moment.
And taking off of where Dr. Mendoza said, I know that there was a, and I'm almost sure it was the Royal Jesters because it's on an album that I used to have. And I don't know if I still have it. It was called Soy Chicano. And it talks about Yo Soy Chicano, Si Señor, you know, and it goes on about ethnic pride, you know, the pride that they had. But so maybe some of the groups were doing, we just don't, you know, they recorded 45s, you know, and they mostly the distribution was with local, you know, San Antonio, probably West Side, you know. So that's where it's they stayed, you know, and that's where they are. And that's they really didn't get the airplay because they were not American enough. You know, the top 40 is not going to play them. And then the Mexican station is not going to play them because we're not Mexican enough. We don't speak the proper Spanish, you know. So it was very limited to whoever would do it. I think Henry Peña referred to a couple of stations that got some airplay that would play some, but it would be like, you know, they'd have an hour a week.
I think what I'll add is that to me, I guess the way I've kind of learned about music myself is in just making the music and making the albums they were making, that was activism in its own, you know, by itself. That was a social movement by itself. I mean, you were seeing musicians. I think Rich in my interview mentions that Sonny could make full Spanish albums and then throw in an English song, and not many people could get away with doing stuff like that. And they were doing these things around the time that, you know, well, and I don't want to get my time frames off, but maybe Gloria or Sylvia can help me. But, you know, I think back when I first started getting into music and learning about activism in music and civil rights and social rights, I started thinking first of Nueva Canción and Mercedes Sosa. And, you know, I think more here, you hear more of what's her name, Joan Baez. And there's all these musicians that played a role in being very explicit about their social activism in their music. And then I think there are some who, in just making the music, that was a method of fighting back and saying, just because you don't want us in the mainstream doesn't mean we don't have a place there. And so I think that's what's been real interesting for me, is to see that confluence, to see all of that come together. because I think sometimes we seem to forget too that sometimes just getting up in the morning and being willing to do something like that is empowering enough without having to be explicit about it.
I think that's true too, because if you do listen to some of the West Side Sound songs, even though they are sung in English, and occasionally they'll throw in some Spanish songs too, the songs are definitely sung with a Chicano accent. The English is sung with a Chicano accent that you can hear. And I think that a lot of folks relate to that because it sounds like the neighborhood, right? It sounds like the barrio. And kind of thinking what Jeremy was talking about too, there is a story about Doug Somm, who is also associated with coming up with the term the West Side Sound and retrofitting it to the genre of music, creating a group called the Sir Douglas Quintet. His name's Doug Somm, but doing that to sort of infiltrate the emerging like rock trend that was happening in the late 60s, early 70s with the Beatles, right? So it was a sort of way to infiltrate and to kind of confuse people based off of that title, but still very much drawing from Black and Chicano Latino musicians from this specific region. So I hearing Jeremy talk, I feel like that resonates. And I think maybe that's why so many people do identify with the music so much, because it is a representation of a very Mexican-American experience or Chicano experience.
Yes, and speaking of Doug Somm, the Sir Douglas Quintet, it's that he did that song, She's About a Mover. And it went on to, he went up to California. He moved out of San Antonio, went to California. But when he put his group together, the Sir Douglas Quintet, it was made up of musicians from San Antonio, most of them. He took them with him. And Mr. Pena also mentioned that when you see the album cover, you see Doug in the front, but the back are just silhouettes because of the musicians, you know, they're not British. They gave up, you know, the British invasion, and they were trying to go off and do something with that, but they were not British. And so the album cover just has the silhouettes because they didn't want to put the actual musicians to confuse people. And he said, when they showed up to gigs, they would come out and they go, "You're not British." And they go, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, you're here, go ahead and play," you know, but it was that factor that he used it. And I mean, it went across, it got airplay, they got bookings, you know, they pulled it off. But it was San Antonio musicians that he used. And that's what up until his demise, he always included or always had San Antonio musicians in his groups, in his music.
Kind of speak again, just on that kind of community presence. We've mentioned the gentleman named Jaime, and you know, I think of places like the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center and places like SACI, even what the community represents in this kind of broader umbrella of this project.
Well, I'll just add real quick that. It's funny you mentioned those organizations. So SACI, the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center, the Esperanza Center have all offered use of their space for these types of interviews. So I've done one at the Esperanza Peace and Justice Center, and hoping to do it. Actually, yesterday, the executive director of the Guadalupe, Cristina Bailly, said, "Jeremy, we need you to interview Joe Posada. You need to interview the West Side Horns." And, you know, that would be really great if we could do that and get that done, you know, here in the theater. And that was without me even giving a whole bunch of background. Like, it was just, "Hey, look, you know, this is what we're doing." So I think the culture institutes see, you know, especially after seeing when they developed GAUSA, right, which was all these arts organizations coming together for a common goal. When they see, you know, projects like this, I think what they're seeing is more activity in arts and culture in general, right? I think they're seeing, okay, we know people are continuing, but it's becoming more popular now to be involved in arts and culture. And so the more we can preserve some of that history, the more we have as arts organizations, and I'm speaking as me, but can't speak on behalf of them. But, you know, the more I see people getting more and more involved with these organizations in particular. So I think it matters a lot. It means a lot to have that participation.
I believe St. Mary's is hosting an event about the West Side generally happening April 8th and 9th. And Rambo Salinas is part of the event, and we'll be talking about sort of generations of music associated with the West Side. So I think that these cultural centers that you mentioned are definitely interested in wanting to be involved in sort of the preservation of our contributions. I think the biggest issue is always funding, to be able to pay folks for their labor, to pay for training, to be able to house things. So we've been really lucky in the sense that Special Collections will be working with us, and that the West Side Community Partnership Initiative is funding the project. But I think looking forward, we would have to apply for larger grants to sustain and to do even bigger things. We will have digital humanities training coming up that will introduce us to what it would mean to create an audio archive. So we have these oral histories, but and I think Jeremy can speak to this too from his interview with Rambo. How do we actually make the music itself accessible if distribution was so tricky back then and we don't have access to like how many records were put out and where they went? I don't know if you want to talk about that, Jeremy.
So yeah, I just recently did my interview with Rambo, and it was a couple Mondays ago. And that was one of the biggest things that he mentioned was, you know, we have all this music and now it's becoming more popular. Grab on to those heritage, those pieces of tangible things that tie us back to our heritage, or that tie other people back to their heritage. Because a lot of the times too, what we're seeing is that it's not just people who, you know, whose parents or ancestors or relatives listen to that music. Now there's people in other communities saying, well, that's pretty cool, and we're going to get involved with this too. And sometimes they're the ones that can afford paying $50, $60 or $70 for a vinyl. And the communities where that music really came from, they cannot, right? And so sometimes you risk losing some of that out because it's different, right? I shared a story with Rambo during my interview that when my grandpa passed, he left, I think it's like 200 vinyl records. And I took them and I was like, these are really cool. Like, they look cool. I didn't pay attention to the music part of them. I didn't have much interest, right? Like I hadn't listened to a lot of that music, and I took them and I put thumbtacks in the middle of them and hung them up on the wall, like the bare record on the wall, and probably ruined a whole bunch of them. And it wasn't until I was moving from that apartment that I pulled them off the wall, and I had the record player sitting there, and I started playing them, and I was like, wow, this stuff sounds interesting. So, and it was Las Hermanas Huerta. I've got some originals of Henry Valderrama. I've got some of the there's like these sets that Vicente Fernandez put together for the movies that he was in. Like, those were all hanging on my wall, like scratching up on the wall. But that's exactly what Rambo was talking about. It's like, you don't know what you have until it's gone, or until, you know, you take it somewhere and think, oh yeah, they're all worth a dollar each. And someone pays you $300 for thousands of dollars worth of records, but because we don't know. Right. And I think that's another part of what's very important about this project is that, you know, there's multiple stakeholders involved. There's multiple schools involved, in this case, St. Mary's and UTSA. And all of that put aside, we're preserving the music, right? We're preserving the music and those memories. And that's more important than the rest of this, right? I think this lives beyond us, definitely in the archives at UTSA, but it lives beyond us in the memories of the families who have done these interviews, because they're like, oh my gosh, you know, one time my grandpa did this interview or did this. And then it also lives, you know, in our shared experiences that we pass down to generations. You know, and I jokingly yesterday said, oh, I'm the youngest person in this group, but we have multiple generations in this group, which usually what you see or at least what I've seen in academic projects is it's usually all academics, usually all in the same generation. You know, There's like younger academics that get together and they're like, we're going to do cool new stuff. And then you see like the older academics who are more traditional most of the time. And so they're all doing their, you know, typical historian research methods. This is different. This is, you know, at least three generations of community members, of academics, of neighbors coming together and saying, we're going to do something that's going to preserve our history. So I can go on forever, so I'll stop there. But hopefully that made sense.
Jeremy, you just put a stake through my heart when you said that with the records. I'm like, no.
Yeah, I'll show them to you one day. I've got a whole but now they're very safely wrapped up. That each one of them has their sleeve. I clean them with, you know, with the right materials and stuff. But yeah, when I first got into records, so I'll just share a quick story. When I first got into records, I was at St. Mary's University, and I would go to Janie's record shop right across the street. Mm-hmm. And I would sit there with Janie, and she would show me. I would bring her records, and she would give me records. And she'd say, here you go. You take this, Mihal, take this. And I would always tell her family, she's trying to give me free records again. Will y'all charge me something? Because she's just giving them away. And they said, if she gives it to you, then we want you to have it, because you're sitting there with her. You're talking to her. You're keeping, you know, her memory active. And I would sing songs with her and stuff. And of course, she just passed, you know, less than a year ago, which is really sad. But, you know, now that I'm here doing this project, I'm like, wow, I didn't get a video of Janie talking about this, you know. I would sit there and listen to her and talk to her, and I have that memory in my head, and I'll have to tell that story myself, but I don't have her talking about it. And I'm not learning that from her, you know. She was 94, you know, that's not going to happen again, right? And so that was really powerful for me in the midst of doing these interviews. It's like, man, I'd love that I'm getting these in, but I missed so many, right? I missed my grandpa before I threw his records on the wall. I missed my friend Janie before she passed. And it's, you know, I sent the interview of my grandma to my mom, and my mom's sitting there crying. And I'm like, why are you crying? Grandma's just talking about music. but she's like, you know, I don't remember my mom talking about this stuff. And, you know, and only back when I was a kid, like, she hasn't talked about this stuff, you know, since before grandpa passed away and whatnot. So it's real nostalgic, if I can even say that at 26 years old, but to have that feeling and to understand that. So.
And I always think about the wealth of knowledge that Janie had. You know, I've been to her records. I went to her record store a couple of times while she was still alive, and she would just talk, just pick an artist. And she had a story. I'm like, oh.
Oh, and she could tell you the record label. She could tell you the, absolutely, you know, when it was first pressed. She could tell you if it was a remake. She knew all of it. Right. And that's what always interested me, was I was like, here I am barely learning about this stuff, and you've got all of this in you. So yeah, Janie was a wealth of knowledge. That famous black and white picture of her that went around after she passed, I took that photo when I was a student at St. Mary's with my cell phone. I walked up to her one day and I said, I'm going to take a photo of you. Is that okay? And I asked her son, Robert, who works at the shop. And he's like, if mama says it's okay, then I don't care. You can take whatever picture. And sure enough, then when she passed, that picture circulated all over the place. And they loved that photo. So I've got my little, you know, pieces of the puzzle there.
And for me, teaching in Mexican American studies, I feel like this is like literally the heart and the reason of why we have Mexican American studies. Sometimes students come into the classroom and they don't know how to identify, right? They know they've heard Hispanic, or they know they're of Mexican descent, but like, what is sort of like the history and the politics around these identifiers? And I think when you do reach back, when you ask elders, when you talk to your own community, and when you're able to be in a setting where you learn about the contributions that people have made to history, music, art, literature, then you do have a sort of sense of cultural pride. And I think that's why folks are so connected to the West Side Sound. I think that's why we're also excited about doing oral history interviews, because you find so much out about your community, about your culture, about your identity. So yeah, hearing these reflections like really makes me excited and really reflects why classes and fields like Mexican American studies are so important.
One of the comments that comes at the end of every semester or even sooner, why did I not learn this sooner? Especially my intro to Chicano studies is why did I not learn this sooner? Why did I have to come to college? But just think about the ones that don't make it to college. You know, I'm glad that part of our MAS Teachers Academy is training teachers that now that they're starting to put it in the schools to train them how to teach this, because it's not just the content. It's so much more. So finally getting exposure to this in high school, mostly in high school, but we're trying to take it down to the middle schools and the elementaries.
In talking with community members and with parents and you know, respected loved ones, you know, you're kind of resurfacing the past in these interviews and whatnot. Is there this kind of this hope that this project can influence the present and kind of going forward? And I believe you said that the project's set to be finished in May. What do you hope that you know the UTSA community takes from it, the West Side community takes from it? What do you hope that San Antonio as a whole kind of takes away from this?
For me, it's just knowing that this is documented and that people have access to it. And when they see it, hopefully it'll bring a memory. It'll instill some pride. You know, it's like, wow, I didn't know that we could do that as Chicanos. You know, I didn't know that we had this kind of talent. I didn't know that, you know, we did this, you know, that went from garage street bands to some of the more well-known, you know, Sonny and the Sunliners made an appearance on American Bandstand, you know. So maybe people that didn't know, you know, where he was from or his roots, you know, his roots can say, wow, you know, this, we did this, we can do this. We have so much talent. We have so much talent around us, especially in San Antonio. Oh my goodness. You know, like I said, I'm not from here. And once I got here, I'm like, whoa, you know, artistic, you know, art. We have so many talented artists, musicians. Oh my goodness. You know, it's like a wealth. It's like this place, a pool full of just talent, writers, you know, literary, you know, just it's just a mecca for all this. And so it gives people, you know, maybe from other towns that are places that say, wow, we can do this. Maybe I'll be the first in my community, you know, to do something like this. I'll be the first in my community and start spreading it out and give people that sense that we can do this. Going to Cesar Chavez, si se puede, you know, si se puede in music, si se puede in art, si se puede in literature, si se puede in education. You know, we can go to college. We can go to college and study this stuff, you know. I think that's a very important note for them to see. If I go to college, what am I going to study? You know, I don't want to be a rocket scientist, you know. So it's like you can come to college and study Mexican-American studies, you know, literature, art, you know, all this stuff is here. You know, it's to communities, tell them, you know, we're here, you know, let's do this. And just for them to learn about themselves. And maybe, like I said, if they have a little talent or whatever, start drawing and do it community wise and inspire. Maybe the community will say, you know, let's put your artwork at City Hall or something, you know, that, and for others to see and appreciate a Chicano did this, you know?
Yeah, I think I hope that people do start talking to and recording themselves. In classes, I do encourage students to use Instagram to document themselves, as well as using it strategically in terms of community building and archiving. I think as I get older, I don't think I was concerned about this as when I was younger, but archiving is super important to me now. And I wish I would have known sooner to talk to my elders, to do sort of these informal interviews with community folks, to save photos. So going with the project, I hope that folks become interested in that. And I hope more opportunities become available, not just to us, but other projects, oral history projects. We do have like the Museo de West Side that is working in the community, right? They have a current exhibit that focuses on women of the West Side. I know that Lerma's nightclub has been saved, the building itself, because it's a historical landmark to the community. And I know that there's going to be archival work happening, community-based work happening there. So I hope that as more folks become interested in sort of archiving and preservation, that also more sites and spaces open up. In a conversation I had with Ramble, he talked about like, why wouldn't San Antonio have a museum of like San Antonio or like South Texas music, right? And I hadn't really thought about that before, but it's so true. Like, how do we not have a museum that talks about our contributions? And I know Gloria is involved in the fight of like, how do we not have curriculum that talks about our contributions, right? Like, how is there not a curriculum in K-12 schools that talks about Chicano art or Chicano music that this hopefully could be a part of too? Oh yeah, so that's sort of my hopes going in.
Sorry, were you gonna say something, Jimmy?
I was just gonna add, you know, you said, do we hope that it'll, you know, change things for the present? I think it already has, you know, maybe not in a large way yet, but to each one of the lives of the people that we've interviewed, they know that their story is being told. And if anybody listens to those, which we know they already have, then we've accomplished something. I think the grant that Dr. Mendoza applied for, only went so far, but I think the other thing that I hope is that people see the importance. You know, we value so much intrinsic, like tangible history. We value the things we can touch so much more, it seems, than the things that we can't touch. You know, stories are being told at the Alamo with the Tapilan people. Stories are being told in different places about different things throughout our city. And we've learned so much in the past few years something that we've known, but something that more people are learning so much more, is that our non-tangible history is just as important as those tangible things you can touch and feel. In some cases, even more important, right? There are people of color for so many years. They're you know, the actual tangible materials were not preserved for a reason, right? You know, there's a lot of conversations, and I bring up the Alamo just because I've had conversations recently, but you know, the documents of those people that were there before, the heroes and whatnot, they were, you know, their documentation is not there intentionally, right? Like, and now we're starting to get to a place where it's like, we have to save these things, right? But had that been done before, it wouldn't be so difficult to provide those primary source records and documents to show that our history was really where it was. It was really present. So I think that for me, we're creating those primary source documents for the future generations that need this material when they want to do research on these things, right? We've hit, to some people, West Side Sound may be a narrow field that we're looking at, but in the future, someone can narrow in even further. It could be West Side Sound only from people on the West Side. It could be West Side Sound, you know, just the listeners of the music, not the music makers. And so we have to start thinking like that. Like, what are we saving other than the tangible history that we have sitting in front of us? So yeah, that's what I got.
And going off of Jeremy, as like he says that some of these tangibles were not saved. It was for a reason, because they weren't valued. They weren't seen as valuable, but they were. They were very, and they are very valuable. And that's, now we're in the process of restoring this, you know, restoring, trying to bring some of this back. And the best way to do it is orally, because some of those artifacts have been destroyed.
I'm going to end with this, just because I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this. This is going back a little bit to what you had said, Dr. Mendoza, about digital humanities, but it was an ArcGIS project called Mapping the Movimiento, about Mexican civil rights movement. And, you know, Edgewood High School is mentioned, St. Mary's is mentioned on the list, Our Lady of the Lakes mentioned as well. Does this project, is it going to encapsulate something related to ArcGIS? You know, you talk about it existing in special collections, but is, you know, is there a part of it that would exist as in the form of something like a GIS thing that people can navigate through?
Yeah. So I did recently apply for training through Kansas State University. I'm messing up the order, but they are known for having a public humanities, digital humanities institute. And so I'll be able to attend in the summer, and I think really open up some ideas as you're discussing on what it would mean to sort of map the music, what it would mean to create an audio archive of the music, and just other potential ideas within that realm. So, and I think they're funded, the Institute is funded through NEH. So I think also learning about what kind of projects have been supported by NEH would really help us kind of shape that as well too. But I do think that that would be really cool, right? To have sort of these mapping projects that locates, and kind of like Jeremy mentioned before, it could locate like the recording studios, right? Abe Epstein is one of the largest ones. What other ones existed, not just in San Antonio, but in South Texas that are well known for producing Chicano music, right? It could definitely map like the homes of some of the musicians or the schools that were involved, very similar to the project that you mentioned. So I think there's lots of potential for that.
I'd like to add that this is by no means, you know, the end of the project. Our hope is to continue to expand on it. We've just touched the tip of the iceberg, and there is so much more. So we'll be looking for more grants to help us expand this. You know, it's all about the money. Unfortunately, that's what it takes. And so we do plan to expand. When and how is the question.